You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Ray Catherine Imey. Very pleased to have her with us. She's a food historian. She's authored several historical recipe books, and she's the co-author of Potluck Paradise, Favorite Fare from Church and Community Cookbook. She's here today to talk about her newest book, Food Will Win the War, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. This book has been called a fascinating story of food preparation, consumption, and policy on the Minnesota home front during World War I. She's going to talk to us about her new book, and then she'll take your questions. Please join me in welcoming Ray Imey.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you all very much for being here. This event is, to my mind, as much a celebration of the University of Minnesota Archives as it is an introduction for you to my work. I couldn't have written this book without archives. There's a reason why the documents and archives are called primary sources. They are words from and letters and notes and correspondence from people, unedited by anyone else. And when you as a researcher have the great opportunity to be able to look through those files, you can get in touch with those people immediately, primally, in some cases. And I think they're, you know, just an extraordinary treasure to be able to do that, and privilege. And I couldn't have written Food Will Win the War without those documents and without the wonderful people at Archives who through the years have collected, organized, cataloged all the papers and documents and guided researchers like me. From the current Archives head, Beth Kaplan, through the students who helped me, and in particular Lois and Karen, who kindly took me under their wings when I innocently walked into the Anderson Library building and said, here's what I'm interested in learning about. The next thing I knew, the research room had piles of boxes filled with magic for me to explore. I quickly learned how to dress for success while doing archival research in documents that are 90 years old. I wore my oldest jeans and one of my husband's old shirt with frayed cuffs, because there's a lot of magic dust in those boxes. I quickly began to feel the impact of the voices. I had a basic historical construct and an intellectual understanding from my research at the Minnesota Historical Society for a program I had done on World War I food and for an article that I had written. And after a couple of months in the archives and a couple of years of writing, the 5,000-word article became a 90,000-word manuscript, which then became a 70,000-word book. Weep. But in looking through the papers, I was just blown away by the power of the emotional contact with these people. Not that they were all lovey-dovey or weepy or wrote emotionally. It was quite the contrary. They wrote almost factually. But there was one moment where all of this came to fruition for me in particular, with particular impact. I was trying to understand what was going on with the potato situation in 1917, where there had been a great famine of potato. The potatoes crops had failed in 1916 and 1917. Everybody planted potatoes. And in 1917, in the fall, there were a lot of problems with an early frost. And so a lot of those potato crops were frozen on the siding and railroad cars and in the gardens. And so there's this energy to find out what to do with these dud spuds. So one farmer sent in this letter to a professor at the university. His name was Lars Eriksson. He was from Eriksonville. And he's writing in this large, loopy hand in pencil on this piece of paper with palpable sincerity. And so Lars said, and I have to read this to you because I won't remember it correctly. I have made a potato grinding mill here to grind not only good potatoes, but frozen potatoes to flour. Too bad the farmers should lose so much potatoes, just now when everything is so well needed. I can make potato mills to run by hand power or with gasoline engines. P.S. My little mill run by a gasoline engine can grind one bushel of potatoes in 1 to 1.5 minutes. This is a little farmer in Ericksonville recognizing this need and that he has a solution. And so Professor Gortner forwarded the letter on to Archie Wilson, who is the head of the Food Commission and also a professor, and said, he is apparently applying the methods of the old country to Minnesota problems. And while his English is at fault, there is nothing the matter with his patriotism. So you can see how it's easy to be seduced by voices like that and want to bring them to life. With 21st century hindsight, I was able to understand what all of these people whose lives I was meeting and work I was seeing accomplished. And although they were undoubtedly proud of their work, I don't think they realized the full magnitude of what they had achieved. This was, after all, the moment when the United States became a world power. And this was achieved as much by the food conservation generosity of Americans from their dinner tables as by the strength of our soldiers. And much of the food conservation in Minnesota and the nation came from the University of Minnesota. All of these actions underscore the importance, the critical importance of the University of Minnesota and how the land grant mission of the university brought the state and its citizens to success. And all those documents from the university, personnel reports to newspaper clippings, publications to letters, formed the spine that linked all of my other research from books and newspapers and state archives and primary sources at the Minnesota Historical Society archives. The Liberty Bread recipes developed in the food labs in the Home Economics Department became the standard for Herbert Hoover's Food Administration. I was able to know that with certainty from articles in the University Farm Review, which some lovely students pulled out and put in front of me up at the University Archives. And God love them, the paper published the recipes. So I've made samples, which we can have later. There are two breads over there, an oatmeal muffin and a rice cornbread. I will warn you, the rice cornbread is a very soft bread. My husband looked at the slices I cut up and said, these look like cheesies, and expected it to be very crisp. And I said, no, he was quite surprised. And I explained it was sort of like a spoon bread. But they're over there in their little tongs you can pick it up with and napkins. I'd like to talk about four files or pieces of information and read a little bit from my book. One is a series of surveys set up by the Farm Bureau, the Boys and Girls Club files, correspondence from Professor Gortner, and finally, and maybe primarily, the files of Archie Dell Wilson, who is a totally amazing man. He was the administrator of the University Farms, and he became the food administrator for the state of Minnesota, and in essence ran the whole food conservation efforts. When I first delved into the files that belonged to the Farm Bureau, there were a whole bunch of administration files and papers, but in the middle of it was this wonderful file of surveys that were sent out on the eve of the war in April 1917 and sent out to all of the agents around in counties around the state saying, help us understand what you will need, where your farms are, what people are growing, what they could grow if they needed to ship crops. It's wonderful data. Not only is it data, it's voices from these men who are out in the field interacting with farmers who were going to have to do the work. And some of them were postmarked back the very day that President Wilson declared war against Germany. It's just astounding. So some of these folks wrote back to F.E. Balmer, who was chief agent of the program. The agent for St. Louis County in northern Minnesota wrote, "Experimenting with new and untried crops at this stage is out of the question. But by all means, grow and cultivate to the fullest extent any crop now known to be safe and reliable." Shipping disruptions had caused some diversion of crops, and in addition to giving solid information about which crops were usually planted in Minnesota counties, the agents were asked how much additional acreage could be cultivated to grow more corn, oats, barley, and spring wheat, because we needed to shift wheat to our allies in Europe. Their answers highlighted other war-related problems. Even before men were drafted into the Army, farmers in Dakota County, south of St. Paul, had trouble cultivating and harvesting crops. Average farm in Dakota County, about 155 acres. Big labor problem. The Grant County agent in the west central part of the state raised another nagging issue. Many of our farmers would resent a campaign for larger production unless they can be shown that fair prices are in sight. Closer to the Iowa border, the Faribault agent recommended, "Men who have studied and followed special courses of crop and food production can be of great assistance in obtaining production of the needed food supply. Farmers who have specialized in certain crops could help with training and experience." The means for sharing this information was readily at hand, the Dakota agent suggested, through dozens of rural organizations. And there was much to be learned. On April 21st, 1917, A.D. Wilson, as head of the state's Food Conservation Committee, sent out a news release saying that Minnesota's agricultural industries are being organized as never before, and perhaps as no other state's farms are being organized, for the quick and large increase of food production and conservation. He concluded that by the end of the crop year, it would be apparent that the state has given its full share of patriotic service to the nation. So Archie is right out there recognizing where the opportunities are, where the problems are, and putting a patriotic spin on it all as part of motivating people to participate. One of the important groups to participate were the youth of the state of Minnesota. The Boys and Girls Club, which is sort of the precursor to the 4-H, jumped right in. They began canning. They began growing gardens. There was a new and improved method of canning that was easy, as easy, people thought would be easy for children to do, and they did, and they demonstrated it at the state fair. Excuse me. The state fair was seen as an important avenue for informing people around the state for new and improved ways to do things. It's always kind of been that. But with the war, where people had to change the way they ate, this was a wonderful opportunity. At summer's end, both in 1917 and 1918, the state fair dedicated itself to the food conservation effort. Children in the Boys and Girls Club, an activity coordinated by the university, demonstrated how to make war bread, which was bread using far less wheat than ordinary bread. The Northwestern Yeast Company of Chicago praised their efforts in a letter. "Judging from the yeast sales throughout the entire United States, we consider that there was far more intelligent use of substitutes combined with regular wheat flour in the homes of Minnesota than in any other state in the Union, due in a large degree to the excellent and constructive work done in the Boys and Girls Club." Despite encouragement, some women remained uncomfortable baking yeast breads. The stakes for bread bakers were high. As one cookbook noted, "Nothing ensures the health and contentment of the family as much as good bread. There is no article of food about which there has been more written, more instructions given, or in which more failures have been made. In short, nothing is more rare than a good loaf of bread." One of the astounding set of documents that I found up at archives was this set of magazines or newsletters called the Junior Soldiers of the Soil. And this was a set of newsletters in which children who had done war work wrote these articles about what they had accomplished and what they had done. Adela Swanson of Goodhue County began her article in Junior Soldiers of the Soil dramatically quoting her younger brother. Ugh! I hate that barley bread! She continued, Mother tried to make it twice, as she had heard it was the most difficult of all the substitute breads to make successfully. After several attempts using both the short and long methods, Adela produced a loaf so light and tasty that her brother complained when she didn't make it. Buoyed by this success, she organized a bread club to teach her friends and their mothers. I am happy in the thought that I've been able to help Uncle Sam in even so trifling a matter. The Boys and Girls Club members demonstrated at the fair. They actually baked bread at the fair and talked the audience through it. They also did canning. Many public schools organized their own canning clubs too. During the summer, students brought vegetables from their gardens and put them up with supervision in demonstration classes. In Niva Johnson's article about the experience, How I Helped Win the War by Canning at Home, she wrote, most of the girls were of the fifth and sixth grade. Although they were small, they did very good work for their age. We named our club the Kill the Kaiser Club. The more we could find out from demonstrating, the better it was for us. I canned a total of 561 quarts of fruit, vegetables, and meats. Next year I will try and can more because I will have an earlier start. It's just astounding to be able to see in these primary documents what these children did. And I don't know how else I could have found it except for archives. Another important, aside from wheat and meats, another important product that was limited was sugar, because most of the sugar came from overseas on ships, and ships were needed for troop transports. So in the spring, late winter and early spring of 1918, after we had been in the war for about a year, Professor Gortner at the university thought, you know, it's within the capacity of most farmers in Minnesota to grow their own sugar. So in the spring of 1917, he sent out a press release, which became an article, urging farmers to produce their own sugar substitutes, and it went out to local newspapers and farm journals. I could almost sense the drama when I started looking at Gortner's files, because here are, in the midst of very tidy, organized university bureaucratic paper with carbon copies and letters and a carbon answer and a letter and a carbon answer, all 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, there's this collection of odd-shaped pieces of paper, penny postcards, notepapers, some business stationery with a printed letterhead, some letters written in pen, some typed, some written in ink, and all these odd things, because people wanted free copies of the bulletins on how to make sugar beet, sorghum, and maple syrups. Gortner put the value of the campaign into perspective in a letter to R.B. Greeley in Monongah. If you can give any publicity to this campaign in any way, I feel you will be doing a patriotic duty. There is no farmer in Minnesota who cannot raise 4/5 of the sugar which his family requires. And the more sorghum or sugar beet syrup that is raised, the more cane sugar will be released for war work. I also feel that there is a handsome profit coming to the farmers who will go to the trouble to manufacture sorghum syrup. And he carries on this exchange with these people who are writing for explanations about how to do all of this. In a letter to Benjamin Waltner of Jackson, Gortner cited the success of the Waconia sorghum factory, which last year made something over 100,000 gallons of sorghum and sold it all before the plant was in operation. While converting sorghum syrup efficiently required economies of scale, making sugar beet syrup could be a farmyard project. And here again, Gortner is explaining. He wrote a letter to K.S. Bergstedt of Lake Park. The process was a simple one. The roots of the sugar beets should be sliced with a kraut cutter. or with a Sterling Rotary Slicer number 10 at $2. The extra cost of the slicer made up in time saved. The slicer should be cut rather thin and 10 gallons of boiling water added to each bushel of beets used. The best container for the beets and water would be a hardwood barrel, which would be covered with a heavy piece of canvas to keep in the heat. After an hour or so, Gortner continued, the water is drained off through cheesecloth, boiled slowly until the syrup is thickened. 10 gallons of drained liquid would yield 1 gallon of syrup. The leftover sugar beets, Gortner noted, would not be wasted, because the extracted slices make valuable food for livestock or chickens. So nothing is wasted. But my absolute hero in all of this is Archie Dell Wilson. He was someone whose name I had run into when I was reading the official state papers, when I saw an occasional newspaper story. But it was being able to look through his files up at the University Archives to see his actual speeches unextracted, to read all of his words, to realize what a marvelous man he was and what an asset he was to the state. In a chapter that I've called "Are You Doing Your Part," I talk a little bit about Archie and his impact. None did their part more effectively than A.D. Wilson, Minnesota's food administrator. He traveled the state from top to bottom, explaining, cajoling, pleading, and motivating individuals and groups on the food conservation battlefield. The founding director of the university's Extension Service, Wilson already knew the state's farmers and the business of farming when he was named in April 1917 to Governor Brenquist's 29-member panel to survey war readiness. Within weeks, he was tirelessly attending meetings, making speeches, investigating situations, and sending out press releases to any and all. He wielded his influence and power deftly, and his persuasive speeches were touched with humor. Memos, letters, and press releases were comprehensive and witty. A release issued near the end of the war, for example, cheers the reappearance of a full supply of sugar for holiday cooking with a salute, "What ho, the cranberry!" When Wilson began outreach to the lumberjacks of Minnesota's North Woods in November and December of 1917, an impressed Bemidji newspaper editor noted, "The United States has their Wilson," meaning President Woodrow Wilson, "and so has the state of Minnesota. And we're going to tell the people of Bemidji and Beltrami County the reason they don't know him is because he's just about the busiest individual to be found in many moons." The folksy account from this editor continued, "He was working like a dock walloper when others were listening to the radiator sing. And what's more, he's been doing just such work with the brass band accompaniment a long way off." Noting Wilson's visit over 2 months to the lumber camps up north, he wrote, "Sunday, this Wilson fellow was up in the Crookston lumber camps of the dense forest in weather that would make an ordinary mortal steal a red-hot stove. We thought, like many others, he was just sort of a swivel chair executive, with a competent core of typewriter hammerers and a theoretical knowledge of how to make a snowball serve as a square meal for the chap who works in sub-zero weather. But we're next to him now." And Archie even went so far as to suggest menus when people were faced with having to do wheatless meals and wheatless days and meatless days. So this is the vegetable generous menu he came up with for a meatless day. For breakfast, cream of rye with figs, poached egg on toast, toast and butter, coffee. Lunch, scalloped cabbage with cream, rye muffins with butter, fruit. And for dinner, baked sweet potatoes, buttered beets, spinach with vinegar, oatmeal bread with butter, and raspberry shortcake. But Archie had a very human side, too. He had a young son, and he brought his young son and his family's experience with this boy into trying to persuade people to continue with their war efforts. In an October 1917 speech in Argyle, Food Administrator A.D. Wilson discussed sugar conservation in personal terms. I have a little boy with a decided sweet tooth. He likes a lot of sugar, and it has been a source of anxiety to his mother and me to see him dip into the sugar bowl and keep dipping and putting sugar on everything he eats. His mother finally convinced him of the idea that he might save some sugar for a soldier. There is something appealing and romantic about a soldier, and it struck his fancy. I wish that every child under 80 in the state of Minnesota would do the same thing. And as the war came to an end, Archie again summed up the experience of everyone and pointed ahead. The American sacrifices and food policies had won the war to end all war, and now it was time to assure the peace. A.D. Wilson wrote powerfully of the road ahead. Peace will bring added responsibilities to America as the food source of the world. Now we must feed hundreds of millions. We must realize that it is our duty as well as our privilege to share and share alike with those who have fought our battles for world peace, and to share our hunger with the hungry Germans as readily as with any other suffering humans. I've been extraordinarily privileged to spend the last 5 years living with Archie and Professor Gortner and Lars Eriksson and the Boys and Girls of the Boys and Girls Club and so many more Minnesotans that I met through my work at the University Archives and the Minnesota Historical Society Files and Archives. I couldn't have known them without the archivists. They are an essential, critical, and vital link between these people's thoughts and accomplishment and those whom we researchers and writers hope our words will reach and inform and move. In my mind's eye, I see them, these Minnesota soldiers and the soldiers of the soil, the homemakers who fought kitchen campaigns against waste and battled through shortages. I see innovators and educators who saw opportunity in the midst of war. As the pressures of war disappeared and peace was fed, these Minnesotans returned to building a successful and progressive state with the energy, insights, and skills honed in this intense experience. The United States became a world power through its military might, its economic strength, and the generosity of its citizens toward people in need an ocean away. The lasting lesson of World War I experience can be found in President Wilson's vision for world peace, quoted on a Food Administration poster at the end of the war. Hunger does not breed reform. It breeds madness and all the ugly distemper that makes an orderly life impossible. The future belongs to those who prove themselves the true friends of mankind. I've been fortunate to come to know these people, and I hope you can come to know them too. Thank you. Questions? I just kind of skimmed across the top. There's an awful lot in here. No questions. Yes?
I've never heard of beet syrup. Does anyone ever make it now, or have you tried it?
No. there are limits to food research, and slicing up beet syrup, beets, sugar beets for beet syrup is about where I drew the line. I think it may be something that you might find if someone is still growing sugar beets, but I think it largely then gets continued to be boiled down into beet sugar. Gortner talked about being able to use it in the canning process, but it was, I think, pretty much a World War I interim step. You know, sort of like the difference between maple syrup and maple sugar, but obviously with a plainer taste profile. You know, people wrote to him about maple trees, too. There were letters from folks who had, you know, I have 1,000 maple trees, and then there were people who had like 5 in their yard, and, you know, how do I get maple syrup out of that? And he patiently wrote back to them all, sent them copies of the brochure, but answered them personally, saying, here's how you can do this. I mean, it's just remarkable that everybody, this is a really short time period. It's 19 months from when the President Wilson and Congress declared war against Germany to November 11th, 1918 at 11 in the morning when the armistice papers were signed. And in that time, there was no time to engage in any kind of rationing. It was all voluntary. Herbert Hoover recognized that food would win the war because we needed to shift what we were growing and eating here to feed our starving, literally, there were starving children in Europe, and to feed our soldiers because we had no standing army. We raised an army of 500,000 men, again, in this very short time period, and there, the food that they were eating on the farm needed to be shifted to the training camps and then overseas. So the way to do that was for everybody to shift away from using wheat, shift away from using meat. There was about a two-month period where it was really intense, where only 3 meals of the 21 that we ate during, that they ate during the week, were unrestricted. And some of them were meatless, some were wheatless, and some were wheatless and meatless. And everybody just sort of jumped right in and said, you know, how can I help? And they did it with this can-do vision and this must-do drive. There was a wonderful food pledge that everybody was encouraged to sign. School children took it around, sort of kind of emotional blackmail. You know, take it to your parents, have them sign it, take it to the neighbors, have them sign it. Collected all of these signed pledges. They were sent to Washington. And the pledge was very simple. You know, I pledge to join the Food Administration and to do in my kitchen so much as I can as to the best of my ability to follow the requests of the food administrator. Being flexible was incredibly important because at one point there were no potatoes in the summer of 1917, but by the time we got around to the spring of 1918, we had way too many potatoes. So it was, you know, eat potatoes by the bushel, not the peck. And potatoes became called potatriots. There were store windows. the store windows were used as communication devices because, of course, this is before there's radio, before there's television, before there's the internet and Twitter and all of that. It was newspapers and newsboys. You know, the multimedia event was the 10-year-old newsboy with a newspaper in his hand shouting extra, extra, and screaming out the headline. So there are, you know, these marvelous World War I posters that you see that went up in store windows and in libraries. There are displays in department store windows, and some of them included, you know, like baking potatoes with little German uniforms on, or, you know, being bayoneted by a potato with a little American uniform on. Just marvelous and creative, and ways to get, you know, a breadth and depth of information, and also a huge persuasive effort, you know, into people's hands, and having kids go door to door to get them to sign the food pledge was an important part of that, as well as the efforts at county and state fairs. It's just astounding and a privilege. And the food is darn good. Yes?
How does this story of Minnesota fit in with what was happening nationwide, food-wise, during the war? Was it consistent? Was it consistent only in the Midwest? Or?
That's a really good question, and I'm not an expert on what national happenings were. You can kind of get a sense of it by looking at the, you know, a couple of the compendiums of World War I history, and they seem to suggest that in most places, most people, you know, jumped right in. I mean, certainly there were some areas where there were problems. There were certainly problems here in the state of Minnesota politically with an anti-German sentiment and some anti-German unfortunate and tragic incidents, but, you know, that's not the story I tell. You know, there are other books that talk about that. You know, I just wanted to talk about food and food policy, and I think that, as far as I can tell, just by looking at national statistics, most places kind of carried right along with it, but Minnesota is in a unique place because we are not only a farming state, we were a late to market farming state because our season starts later. So in the spring of 1917, when other states had already planted, we were able to shift immediately into crops that could impact the war more quickly. And because we had the university, I did see an awful lot of stuff from the university, the Home Ec Department, in particular the recipes, going into federal information and distribution. Cornell in New York also provided a lot of that kind of material. You'd see things slugged with Cornell letterheads, and University of Missouri did some too. And I imagine all the farming states kind of made their impact, but that I know for sure that the Liberty breads developed by our home economists here at the University of Minnesota were some of the leading breads that were used, certainly indicates that Minnesota did play a leading role. And one of the first people who went to Washington, Josephine Berry, had been a University of Minnesota home economist, and she left the U to go work in Washington in June of 1917. So there's that kind of immediacy of influence as well. Yes?
You said quite a bit about the need for food to feed the starving people of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, World War I began in 1914 and was tearing the whole continent apart long before we got into it. My question is, did any of this need for Minnesota food to feed the starving people, did that start before our war entry?
Yeah, the question is, because I said there were starving children in Europe. Europe had been at war since 1914, and did we in fact impact food needs before our entry into the war in April 1917? And the answer is yes. There were, from the time that Herbert Hoover, who got trapped in Europe right at the beginning days of the war, and saw the chaos that exploded when everybody started attacking everybody else and everybody declaring war on everybody else, and it all just erupts into this maelstrom in August of 1914, Hoover recognized pretty quickly that food and food control would be an important part of what happened in Europe. So he set up the Committee for Relief in Belgium and was in charge of that for 3 years until he became the food administrator here at our entry into World War I. And you see Mr. Edgar, who is head of publisher of Northwestern Miller, someone who aggressively joins in with Herbert Hoover, and they gather up wheat and they gather up flour and they make shipments to Germany. And at one point, Edgar is accompanying a shipment of wheat across the ocean, and he's on the ship with the wheat, and they're going to bring it into harbor at Rotterdam, and they're going through the North Atlantic, where German had submarines sinking this, that, and the other ship. Although at that point, in 1916, they were not actively attacking peaceful ships. But he said, he wrote a letter to his wife. He said, "So here I was, and had a deck of cards in my hand that came from the Washburn Crosby flour mill. And their slogan at the time was, 'Eventually, why not now?' Meaning, eventually you will buy this really fine flour, so why don't you buy the gold medal flour now?" So he looked at it and he said, "You know, apropos of nothing else, I'm thinking, eventually, am I going to get blown up by a submarine?" But he made it safely. But yes, we were, to some degree, supplying wheat and other grains to Europe. But when we also shifted to our troops, both in training and in battle, the whole need ratcheted up much more aggressively. Any other questions? Well, thank you all very much for coming. Thank you for your interest in the book and for your attention. And if you have any other questions later on, I'll be around for a little bit. So thank you so much.